it's Labor Day week, and there's an awful lot we need to focus back in on after the holiday. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Very good to be back. Glad to be back live, or live on tape, as they used to say.
As live as we can get, yeah. on an early Thursday morning.
In early TV back, they said, this program is live on tape. And I'm like, okay, well, what does that mean? Well, it basically means that we're live together. We're not doing a rerun. And our apologies for last week. I'm not sure what Mike played because I didn't meet the deadline to get the program over. So he played something in our spot. I'm assuming.
Chuck, you and I were just talking the other day about how many years we've been doing this program, and I think missing one deadline in all that time is, I think it's forgivable.
Well, I'm going to make an admission that I have missed other deadlines, and sometimes it's due to equipment error. I have, from time to time, sent things over. We do it with a file exchange program, so you can send large files through the email. And what you do is you send a link and it goes into the cloud and all that stuff. Well, things have gone into the cloud and never reemerged. It's happened from time to time. And, I'm not sitting right by my computer on the day when the stuff is due, and I'll get a note from WLRY that says, how come you haven't sent us a show this week? And I don't get it on time. And that didn't happen this time. I just plain forgot.
Well, and that's okay, Chuck, but it's interesting you're bringing that up and talking about file sharing, Dropboxes, and all this other good stuff, and how we record and then we save it off to an electronic file, and it's just amazing because you stop and you think about how much easier it is today for people to share information. I was reading an article the other day, it was something out of the Plain Dealer about the celebration of, I think it was like the 50th anniversary of the Born Loser comic strip. And of course, that caught my eye because I'm a comic guy. I like comic books and stuff. That's kind of my niche area of collection. And, they were talking about how Art Sansom, who was the creator of Born Loser, and of course, if you ever picked up a local newspaper, well, maybe not the Dispatch, since they really don't carry anything that good anymore. If you picked up a newspaper or Sunday comic strip in the past and you saw this poor guy, Brutus Thornapple, who basically nothing ever went right for, but Art Sansom used to draw those comic panels, and it was a four-panel strip. And they talked about how he had to put them done, and he'd try to be weeks in advance, but he would still have to rush to the airport to put the package on the last flight out in order to get there in time for the Sunday edition of the newspaper that was syndicating him. And, it's like, you think about that, Chuck. I mean, with radio, it used to be a time, and if you wanted to do radio, you had to go and schedule time in the studio of the radio station and then go in at that time and, have all the restrictions, limitations, record your program, do all those things, or you would, record it somewhere else on a tape. And I'm not talking a disc, guys. I'm talking like a reel-to-reel tape.
Yeah.
And then you'd have to put it in a can and then seal it down and then, special deliver it to the studio or the station that you were playing on. And, if you happened to have a program that was syndicated at that time, you had to make multiple copies of that tape and send it to a number of different stations. Unless, of course, they were on a repeater or on a shared transmitter where, you could get double your bang for your buck. A lot of things have changed, haven't
they? Boy, have they. Barry, if we were doing this show as short a time ago as probably the early 2000s,
right?
We would have had to have submit this program on a cassette tape.
On a cassette tape, that's right. It went from reel to reel tapes to the cassette tapes. I'm not sure anybody ever had to send CDs because I think at that time computer technology got to the point that email and portable document formats and audio and WAV files and audio files started actually being, manageable.
Well, yeah, we could have put it probably on a CD if you had a CD writer. Now, I've had CD writers early, and I forget how much data CD will hold. One of these programs is about 100 megabytes of information.
I think I remember it was like 750 megs or something like that early.
Think about this. Everybody was using a floppy in the 90s. It would have required about 120 floppies to put this program on floppy.
Right.
Now, we could have compressed the file, and it might have fit on maybe 55 or 60 floppies. But nonetheless, when the CD came out, it was a real breakthrough. And then, of course, the writable DVD. Well, the DVD will hold gigs of memory, gigs of stuff. And even so, we can transmit files through a cloud method that are, you know, there are still limits. For instance, we use a free program. And by free, it's basically, you know, it's peppered with ads.
Right. Yeah. We have to like go through the minefield of, okay, which one of these buttons do I click on to actually do the thing that I am wanting the program to do and not send me over to some ad?
To actually download the file rather than download an ad.
Right.
I think there's a 300 megabyte limit. You could send a very large program with 300 megabytes, even at that. Let's say we did a multiple segment program. Let's say we did one of these conservative talk show jobbies where it's 3 hours long. Okay, we would send three 100 megabyte files. We wouldn't send one 300 megabyte file and just say, here's part one, here's part two, here's part three, put them together, and you can stick an ad in between if you're going to do that because, you know, these stations need their break time. They've got other things to do. Even WLRY, which is a nonprofit, runs ads in between segments for programs coming up, Bible readings, church messages, all kinds of stuff that they run, you know, pro-life ads. And that's no big deal. In fact, I know that Mike does some magic on our show when we send it in, and he inserts ads in places where we didn't intend them to go, but we don't care. It doesn't matter. I mean, he puts in some announcements. He puts in some of our own advertisement because you and I both run ads on this thing. Mine for my Rain Rock Nutritionals company and you for your consulting firm and your lobbying firm. And he puts those in spots, usually at the beginning. Like when you do your little teaser at the front, he'll break it there and put in things. So that's part of the magic of the radio.
Sure.
What you hear coming out isn't exactly what it sounded like going in.
Right, but one thing that doesn't change, Chuck, is the fact that you and I still have to sit down in front of microphones and talk about what's going on or record something of interest in order to put it in that electronic file or way back when put it on those reel-to-reel tapes to get it out on the airwaves.
That's right.
So you know what? There are certain things that no matter how much technology changes, certain fundamentals never change, right? Well, I think it's interesting, and I'm using that kind of illustrate a point here, Chuck, and you know where I'm going to with this.
Yep.
When we're here now, and of course, you know, we're after Labor Day, which means we're now into that magic under 60-day window before the greatest presidential race in history, right? You know, the one that's going to determine the fate of the humanity. If we don't get this one right, we're doomed, right? At least that's what we hear. You hear it a lot. You hear it from many quarters. Well, I want to read, and again, here's just a reiteration of this. I want to read you something that I just picked up. I just got a magazine in the mail yesterday, and I'll tell you a little bit later where the magazine was from and who's it from. But the first article starts off with this quote. It says, "I believe this country is facing today one of the most serious and crucial elections in history. I do not believe there has ever been a time, even in the days prior to the Civil War, that we as Americans have gone to the polls with greater issues than those at stake in the coming presidential election. I am convinced that the direction we take from this point on will determine not only the ultimate fate of our nation, but also the fate of the entire democratic world as we know it today." Unquote. Now, Chuck, I asked you to guess who said this quote.
Yeah, and I didn't do very well, did I?
Well, that's okay. That's because, you know, the point is that we've heard this same similar phrasing quote from so many voices out there, mainly from folks on the conservative evangelical Christian camp. We and you went down a number of names, and I kind of laughed because I'm like, yeah, every one of those people could have and probably have said some form of this. But no, Chuck, and just to show you that some things never change, this was said, in a quote, in an article from Christian Life magazine by Billy Graham in 1952. 1952, and an evangelical national figure leader believed that this is the most serious and crucial elections in history. There's ever been a time that we have gone to the polls with greater issues than those at stake in this presidential election. But Chuck, when we say to people, yeah, we've heard, we don't get this one right, the fate of the free world, we've heard this every election cycle. I said going back to like the 80s, but I really, honestly, now we're going back to the 50s, and it's probably even been before that.
Yeah, it's now, what, 64? That's 64 years ago.
64 years ago. That's right. That was 1952, remember, folks. This is 2016. And if I hadn't given you the context of that quote, you would have thought it was an evangelical Christian national leader of today. Because many of them are saying exactly that, Chuck. I mean, well, that's the whole point. But the point is, Chuck, and what I'm getting at is, things have changed radically since 1952. One of the ways that they've changed is people now have, since we're talking about the magic of technology and electronics, you now have much more access to information than we've ever had before. I mean, we now know if a candidate slips, sneezes, falls, faux pas, or otherwise creates chaos on the campaign trail within a 24-hour news cycle, and actually it's probably within a 10-minute news cycle now that we have basically Instapundits and video, phone videos and everything else that can be posted up to the web immediately. We, as a voting public, have a much greater access to information about candidates than I would say that many people, including Billy Graham, had in 1952.
Oh, absolutely.
Because in 1952, Stringer reporters would go out on campaign trails and they'd file stories either by typing them on typewriters or calling them in over the phone lines to typists and editors at the back at the home newspaper. And then if they, you know, depending on when a campaign event happened, it would either go in the next day's news or the day after. So it may be up to 48 hours before an event or an issue or a quote or a comment from a candidate that could turn an election actually ever hit that the public knew about it, other than the small number of the public that might have been live at the event at the time.
Well, think about this, Barry. In 1952, there were a number of major cities, New York, I think D.C., mm-hmm. Los Angeles, Detroit, Chicago, name a place, Columbus, Ohio, that yeah. had at least two daily newspapers. Indianapolis had two.
Oh, sure, absolutely. I remember the old Citizen Journal.
Yeah.
Then the days when the Dispatch wasn't the only newspaper in town.
Right. And, I mean, Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News.
Right.
You had, you know, the Indianapolis Star, and I'm trying to remember the other one, the Star. It doesn't matter. And the reason that happened was usually one was a morning paper and one was an evening paper.
Exactly.
And the reason for that, and if you watch old movies, what's the big thing? Extra, extra, read all about it, right?
Exactly, yeah, because the evening edition would come out with news that the morning edition couldn't capture.
What that meant was there was enough important news that the newspaper felt the need to print an extra edition.
An extra edition, that's right.
And that's where that came from. Extra, extra, read all about it. The newsboys would stand on the corner and people would rush to buy a newspaper. Now, does that mean that for instance, the radio before television didn't have the news? Well, no, they had the news, but it's like it is now. It's headline style. If you wanted detail, you had to read the newspaper. And we have really lost that. And the problem is people have stopped reading the newspaper because they've discovered that they've been lied to for so long through the newspaper. And plus, by the time the news comes, we've gotten used to getting our news instantaneously. You can set your phone up, your dumb smartphone, my redundancy there, your dumb smartphone. You can set your dumb smartphone up to ding when things happen. You know, if something important comes up and there's a new headline, you can set your phone to ding so you can go check your news source of choice. So can we get news fast? Oh, yeah, we can get news. Now, are we getting news better? I don't think so, Barry. The same problem persists in news and opinion that has always existed, and that is that there's bias. There's a worldview bias.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Woohoo, surprise.
I know where we're going to now.
Yeah. But the fact is that when you see pundits on the air talking about the news and making fun of people, I mean, one of the big industries right now is, unfortunately, millennials have decided to take their news from people who are actually admitting that what they're doing isn't really news. For instance.
And Chuck, it hasn't been for such a long time.
Right.
I mean, if people can remember not too long ago, Dan Rather basically completely made up a story in order to smear a president.
Yeah, and complete with, except what he did was, he didn't make it up himself.
He allowed it to be made up, and then he reported it as a fact.
That's it. He sat there while it was reported as fact and basically was the conduit, and the evidence was so flimsily concocted that everybody knew it was fake, except him, right. Apparently.
Except him. He was the only completely caught unawares person in the room.
He and his producer, a woman, if I remember right, by the name of Mary Mapes, who were so set on getting George W. Bush. And when I say getting, I don't mean in a good way. I mean, let's get him.
Yeah, let's bring him down.
They were. This is what happens. In these worldview situations, your focus becomes not exposing the news, it's exposing the person.
Right.
And knowing full well that the news might very well expose the person, what do they do? They concocted a story about George W. Bush avoiding Vietnam service by somehow hooking up with the National Guard, Air National Guard. And made up all these stories and basically fake documents. They took in fake documents that were fairly easily debunked by even...
Yeah, because they realized that the quote-unquote typewriter that these documents were written on hadn't been developed.
Had not been invented yet.
In the time frame that the letters were supposed to have been written in.
Exactly.
Because of the way the font was on the keys.
So... You know, that being said, he's not the only one. And in fact, you see it nightly. You see people who will emphasize something and de-emphasize something else in order to paint a picture. And that's what journalists do. Now, if you're really dependent upon the 6:30 news as your only news source, you're going to get a terribly skewed view of what's actually going on. Because don't kid yourself. And this has been going on forever. I can remember my parents in the 1960s. There was a guy who used to who had come through doing World War II reporting. A guy named Eric Severide, very big deal. My parents had nicknames for all the newscasts. Eric Severide was Eric Neverwright.
Neverwright. Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, there was Huntley and Brinkley, who my mom and dad always referred to as Frontley and Pinkley. Daniel Snore.
Frontley, are you saying that these news reporters and political pundits mainly are just mouthpieces for the parties and the interests behind them who are basically writing it up for them as they go along?
I would go further, deeper than that.
You go further.
Yeah. Do they shill for a particular party? Well, whichever party is the most, for instance.
Well, I don't believe Rachel Maddow shills for the Republican Party. Let me make sure everybody's clear on that. Almost positive that Sean Hannity does not shill for the Democratic
Party. No, and let me tell you, for instance, Lawrence O'Donnell came out the other day. And actually, Lawrence O'Donnell is an old-time Democratic Party operative. Has been for, but he's extremely critical of Hillary.
Yeah.
He doesn't like Hillary. Well, the reason he doesn't like Hillary is because she has been quote unquote pro business. Well, she's not really pro business. She's pro certain big businesses that give her lots and lots and lots of money into the foundation. But O'Donnell doesn't like that because he says it's buying influence. Well, of course it's buying influence. Oh my gosh, come on. I mean, that's part of the whole Clinton foundation problem. That's exactly the point. But some of these guys, are there cracks in the facade? Yes. And do they think independently from time to time? Yes. But nonetheless, I can assure you that Lawrence O'Donnell has an extreme globalist, socialist totalitarian, he has that particular worldview. Now, if you mentioned that to him, he would deride, belittle, and basically cut your microphone off so you couldn't defend yourself anymore. But these are the facts, and this is why programs like, for instance, Principles and Policies is out there because, do we have a huge listenership? Anybody that would try to read this program would find out that they'd say, hey, there's nothing there. There isn't. We do this on we're an audible service. But we don't have a huge listenership, but we have had some influence because I have heard people using some stuff that we have put out there. And as far as I'm concerned, more power to them. They don't necessarily credit us. I'm like, I don't care. This is not about credit. It's about talking about these worldview issues and getting the ideas out there. If somebody wants to steal our ideas, whatever. If you want to use our, snippets of our, as long as you use them in a coherent fashion where you're not cutting them up into pieces and making us say things we didn't say, use it.
Oh, absolutely.
That being, and we go back to this Billy Graham thing, 1952, he's saying this. Do you know who the presidential candidates were in 1952?
Oh, the Billy Graham in 1952? Yeah. Let me think. I think that was Harry Truman.
Nope.
Oh, okay. That was after Truman.
That's right. This would have been Eisenhower.
That was Eisenhower.
Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson.
Adlai Stevenson,
who right? was...
Yeah,
who,
okay. All right.
Who was governor of Illinois.
Illinois, that's right.
And a liberal, to say the least. To be clear... Eisenhower was an unknown quantity.
Well, actually, no. Eisenhower was a known quantity because, that's right, in 1952, because I was thinking 56, because they ran against each other twice.
Yes, they did.
And I'm sorry, I was thinking the 52 was the second run, it's the first run. So Eisenhower was known in one sense because of the General Dwight David Eisenhower for his work during World War II.
Listen, there's a lot of stuff out there that make that election look a lot like this one. Except,
true.
Yes, and let me put it this way. Eisenhower was no conservative. He was a globalist, and he was part of the forces that we would today call the Rockefeller wing of the party. In fact, that's right. Falling out of favor.
The establishment wing.
GOPE. Yeah. In essence, the nomination, the real guy at the convention was Taft.
Uh-huh.
Was Robert A. Taft.
Robert A. Taft, yes.
Robert A. Taft.
The one who you would consider to be a conservative.
And what happened was the GOP establishment stole the nomination from Robert A. Taft. Now, I'm not going to go into details because it's been so long since I read about this, I don't remember it all.
So were people in the establishment, did they want to, if Taft would have been the nominee, would they have been calling for, say, Dewey or who was there was another guy, the socialist part, Alf Landon, right?
No.
Who am I trying to remember? There was would they have been calling for the socialist to be on the debate stage with Robert Taft?
Okay.
Had he been the nominee?
I think in that election, I'm trying to think who the 1952, there was probably a third party. And most likely, it seems to me that some Southern Democrats were, it's too long that I don't remember the details of this. But there wasn't really anybody that was making any much noise in 1952.
Well, except for Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the driving force behind getting Eisenhower as president.
And Henry Cabot Lodge was a GOP establishment. You have to remember the Lodge family goes back way, 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 way back in Massachusetts, in Massachusetts politics. But that being said, here the GOPE won in that particular case, and what the reason they wanted Taft out was because Taft wasn't enough of a globalist. Taft was not enough of an establishment, go along to get a line corporatist guy, and so they broomed him out in favor of basically a Socialist Party A and Socialist Party B, which was it was Eisenhower was sort of a centrist, quote unquote, and Stevenson was more or less a centrist, at least by reputation. So what you had basically was almost no choice. Now, did Stevenson do well in that election? No, he did not, because people were sick and tired of Harry Truman, and so they were drawing the contrast between they were trying to draw. Truman came right out and endorsed Stevenson, and therefore everybody said, "Well, he's a Stevenson. Stevenson is a Truman clone, and we don't want any more Truman." Truman should have been unelected in 1948, if you recall the famous headline, "Dewey defeats Truman."
Right. Yes.
And Truman holding it up, and he's laughing because he just won. Really, public sentiment was against Truman in 1948. The problem was the weather was so bad, nobody came out and voted. The Republicans were so confident of victory that nobody came out and voted. So Truman won. That being said, Billy Graham is saying these things because people are very, very unhappy that Robert Taft and the Republican Party were very unhappy that Robert Taft had the nomination stolen from him.
Right.
So they were talking about not supporting him.
And now, who was a key individual at the convention who helped Eisenhower steal the nomination from Truman?
I'm trying to
because he was rewarded handsomely for his efforts.
Well, I think it was Nixon.
Richard Nixon, who became the vice presidential nominee for Dwight David Eisenhower after that 52 convention.
And then almost lost it over because the press hated him. And if you understand why the press hated him, he knocked a woman. Oh, we're going into way political minutiae here, but he knocked a woman out of a congressional seat named Helen Gehagen Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
Helen Gehagen Douglas was in fact undeniably a Marxist, and they said that Nixon red scared her out of office. Well, she should have been red scared out of office because she was a Stalin apologist, and was all about getting as far left judges into seats and that kind of thing during her tenure. Okay, Nixon knocked her out by basically red baiting her, there wasn't much baiting to be done. So the press turned against him for that because for some reason they were all very pro FDR. See, we're getting back into the press again. The press was all very pro FDR and. And Helen Gehagen Douglas was considered a kind of a protege of FDR. Well, if you don't know who Helen Gehagen Douglas is, have you ever heard of the actor named Melvin Douglas?
Oh, yes.
Melvin Douglas was Helen Gehagen Douglas's husband.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Okay. So,
and a fine actor he was.
Yes, he was. He was a good actor. He was a screaming leftist, but he was still a good actor. That's the problem. I mean, you can reject people over there. Okay, just shut up and act. Don't want to know what your political views are.
Yeah, that's the whole point. I really don't care today who Brad Pitt or you name the Hollywood type who thinks that, you know, they're going to weigh in, or all of these, you know, millennial something or other young singers, the rock stars who basically come out and support Hillary Clinton. Who cares?
Well,
the Lena Dunhams of the world, you know, who are on a feminist bent and like, well, you need to, you know, vote for her. No, you go ahead and vote for who you want to and you leave me alone. You go act if you know how to act, and I'll deal with the real world over here.
Well, look, some of these people are counterproductive to what people want done. They want to, you know, these associations aren't necessarily positive. Like you just mentioned Lena Dunham. I don't think that's necessarily a positive association with Hillary Clinton. But that being said, you go back to this thing. The press was very anti-Nixon. They were not so anti-Eisenhower. You have to be careful with Eisenhower, because what was Eisenhower? He's a war hero.
And that's really what he ran on. He did his whole strategy during the election. He never directly attacked Adlai Stevenson for anything. He attacked the Truman administration.
That's it.
And he then used his position as a war hero to point out the dangers of what was coming on the international scene.
Well, let's talk about that. Go back to that Billy Graham quote. Here we have a guy who attacked Stevenson by proxy by attacking Truman, because, again, everybody associated Stevenson with Truman. Okay, so what was the big deal here? People were talking about not coming out and voting for Eisenhower, who were, quote-unquote, if you will, evangelical Christians. Said, yep. No, neither one of them have earned my vote. And especially at this point, the betrayer, who they viewed as Eisenhower, who was shoring him up? Billy Graham. Billy Graham comes out, says, this is the most important election in our lifetime.
Right, and I'll read that in quotes again. The country is facing today one of the most serious and crucial elections in history.
Yes, in history.
Not just in our lifetime, in all of history, Chuck.
I want to point out a mathematical fact. 64 years ago, our republic is 240 years old this year.
Right.
Okay? That is, 64 years ago is more than 25% of the life of the republic.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. This is 25% of the life of the republic ago. We were talking in these terms. Now, okay, this is the most important election. And you know why? Supreme Court justices were in part of that mix.
Oh, absolutely.
Who did Eisenhower appoint as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States?
Was it Frankfurter, was it?
No. Earl Warren.
Warren. You know what? I was going to say Warren, and then I thought, no, wait a minute. He was appointed later. No, you're right. It was Earl Warren.
Earl Warren, who was one of the worst justices, let alone chief justices, in the history of the Supreme Court. Earl Warren basically created the current atmosphere in which the courts are viewed as having absolute final say, and also where courts have stepped in and usurped state power for the federal government. So, we had to elect this Republican, Eisenhower, to make sure that all the policy decisions went correctly, and that we got the right judges. How'd that work out, Barry?
No, not so well.
Yeah, exactly.
But again, here's the thing with a mixed message, Chuck. And, you know, as I mentioned, that was the opening statement of this Billy Graham comment in the magazine Christian Life from 1952. Now, here's the close of that same quote. I mean, it was like, it's basically a two-page article, and it's all just what he said in this article about voting. So he goes around this whole idea. And he basically says the whole key to a successful democratic world, in his opinion, is the church. And I believe that he's right in one sense, although I don't like the whole small d Democrat thing. But he gets down to the end of the thing. And I think that, you know, if this is where if we don't remember this part, and I'm going to give Billy Graham some credit, he wrapped this thing up correctly. You know, I think he kind of overplayed the hand on the front end, saying this is, you know, the most significant election in history, and da 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 da. If we don't get this one right, the fate of the free world is, you know, the tips in the balance. You know, just like you're saying today, and we said 4 years ago, and 8 years ago, and 12 years ago. I don't buy that game. Okay. But this is what I do appreciate of what Billy Graham said in this article in 1952. And he said here, "It's the easiest thing in the world for us as Christians to think of national and world politics as something involving men and women of the world. That's where we fail. Our job as Christians is to make the impact of Christ felt in every phase of life, religious, social, economic, and political. But we must not do it in our own strength or wisdom. We can only do it as we surrender ourselves completely to God, allowing Him to work in us." Unquote. Chuck, that's the secret sauce.
Yeah.
That's the part of the equation that doesn't get factored in by most people today who think that, you know, you have to go and, you know, and run hither, thither, and yon, because if we don't do this and we don't pick the right guy or gal, or, you know, depending on your stripe, then it's all over. The Republic is doomed, which, you know, the Republic was doomed after the Civil War. The Republic is doomed, and we're going to go into the dark night of tyranny and da, da, da. And you know what? There may be some truth there, but it may not matter which person you pick to be president. It does matter if you're not obeying and following the God that you say that you serve, and who, by whose son's name you are called Christian. That's really what it gets down to, Chuck. Whether, and you know what? That was as true in 1952 as it is true today in 2016, technology notwithstanding.
So, it's amazing the echoes of 64 years ago reverberating in September of 2016.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know what? I wanted to bring this up because, you know, as I got this magazine, and this is actually the magazine that I got, is this, I don't have Christian Life from 1952 sitting here. I'm not that big.
Yeah, that's right.
I have this month, September 2016's Decision Magazine, which is the magazine from the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. It's their election special. And on the front cover, they have a picture of Hillary and Donald Trump, like, facing each other in the thing, Two Visions, Two Americas. And then they start with this quote, and I'm thinking, okay, you know what? If we just went back and looked and kind of, you know, downplayed the first part of Graham, Elder Graham's speech about, you know, how historic this is, and it's never happened before in history, because it has and it will again, and it keeps going. But we looked at that other end of the speech, and the fact that we're kidding ourselves if we think somehow that, you know, we have, you know, we are, you know, have to be worldly in order to have an impact. We have to follow Christ. We have to follow Him truly. Now, you know, Chuck, people of good faith and conviction will argue vehemently as to why we need to vote for someone who says, you know, either they support the killing of defenseless unborn children, they support the, you know, perversion of God's plan for marriage. They don't believe that they have to ask God to forgive them for anything. Those are some of the choices we have out here. We have to be careful, because things we do here as believers who call upon the name of Christ, yes, if you are forgiven by God, your sins are covered, they're forgiven. But if we willfully rebel against God in these ways, surely we will pay a price, a penalty, in the temporal here and now. We may get, you know what the old saying is, be careful what you wish for, you might just get it. We got to be careful here. Now, people will say, well, we only have two choices. And, well, you know, we can't have her because Hillary's horrible. So we got to have Donald Trump. Okay. You know, that if you've bought into it, if you've listened to the pundits, and I want to get back to that because that was a really, really good article that I want us to talk about. Somebody from the left, folks, you know, an article by Leonard Pitts, who is a columnist out of the Miami Herald, who usually is a fairly consistent leftist. Basically, and of course, you know, he's trying to poke a stick at conservatives, but his headline is "How Conservative Pundits Help Break Reality." And it's what we were talking about, okay, are we really reporting news, or are we managing talking points from parties and from people in power in order to create an affinity and to drive people to do something that's not in their best interest? And I think that we have to be careful here because we have a higher standard. You know, Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh are not the standards by which we should pick a president. It should be the word of God. And Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton should be the standard by which we pick a president. It should be the word of God. Now, if we can go honestly to the word of God and we can search the scriptures and we can understand that, you know, God sets up kings and takes down kings, and we're to pray for those in authority over us to have a peaceable and godly life in all honesty, and that Romans 13 is true, and that the civil magistrates are ministers of God appointed by him for good works, and that we've been given the blessing of being, for such a time as this, of being here in this country under the rules that we have in order to pick someone to be the head over us in a political sense, in a civil magistrate sense. If we can go through all that and then honestly come out the end and feel absolutely convinced and convicted that we're doing the right thing and we are honoring God when we cast our ballot in November, well then, you know, by all means, that's between you and God, and you know, we pray that you're right. You know, I had a lovely conversation just last week with a small handful of fairly well keyed in Christian conservative pro-life leaders who were aghast that I'm not on the Trump train. And I just basically said, you know what? I hope you're right. Well, everything you're saying about the reasons why you want to support, you're going to vote for Trump, I hope you're right. I really do. Trust me. I don't hope for the collapse and the destruction of America. I don't hope for socialism to be the official governing organizational idea in our country, even though it really is these days. I don't hope for Christians to be persecuted, although I know that, you know, even our scripture promises that we will be persecuted for Christ's namesake. I don't wish any of that. But as God has enlightened my conscience by the illumination of his word and his spirit, Chuck, I just personally can't see any way clear of voting for either one of the, you know, two primary candidates that appear on the cover of Decision Magazine in September of 2016.
And yet that is essentially the choice that you were told about, and I'm guessing, now I don't have a copy of the magazine you're reading, but you're basically, it's being set up as the race between these two without acknowledging the fact that there are other choices.
Right. And now, whether there are any other choices that are any way equally as palatable, I don't know. Because,
well,
Gary Johnson obviously got some significant baggage issues. Darrell Castle, although, you know, the Constitution Party actually just got announced that they will be allowed write-in access on the Ohio ballot because they were not allowed to, you know, the Constitution Party doesn't have a ballot line in Ohio, but they are going to be officially recognized for ballot, you know, counting purposes. So if you write in their ticket, then it counts on your vote. And of course, you know, there'll probably be others appear because, you know, there are still some fringe and wing entities that show up during a presidential election year that we don't even hear about.
For instance, the Green Party and the Libertarian Party. Libertarians are usually perpetually have an actual ballot line. I'm guessing they will have an actual where you can go actually press the button and vote for. And I don't know about the Green Party. They have it on and off. I don't know if you heard or not. Jill Stein is being prosecuted for vandalizing a pipeline in North Dakota.
Oh, okay. No, I had not.
Yeah,
heard
that came out in the news.
Well,
North Dakota, the state attorney general is basically going to file charges against Jill Stein, and who's the Green Party candidate for president, and a number of other people for spray painting graffiti on a pipeline, which means they had to trespass to do it and that kind of thing. So
I wonder. So I mean, because you know, there's obviously clear and you know, physical evidence there. I wonder how soon it's going to be before some state attorney general in some state in the country files charges against Hillary Clinton for damaging, you know, for treason against the United States for this email situation, which, by the way, in case you missed it, over the Labor Day weekend last week on Friday afternoon, the FBI released more information that there were over 17,000 emails that she did not submit to them in their initial ask when she said she'd given them everything. So, Chuck, you know, that's withholding information and evidence from federal investigators. That in itself is a crime. Is Hillary Clinton going to be prosecuted? Of course not. Not unless some state attorney general decides to come up with some way of, you know, creating a unique case file, which I doubt very seriously is going to happen. But it would be, I could see certain attorneys general in certain states doing that.
I'll be quite honest. What will put a stop to that, make it not happen, is this exceedingly ill-conceived attempt to put a gag in the mouth of those who oppose the junk science of global climate change that prosecutors in New York and a number of other northeastern and far western states have attempted with this attempted indictments of some of these oil company execs. I don't know if you've been following that or not, but it is beginning to sort of be the proverbial lead balloon. It's not floating, and not only is it floating, it's beginning to drag down those who attempted to do it, because everybody recognizes what that is. That's an attempt to hijack the scientific process and stop anyone who opposes the idea that there is such a thing as man-made climate change. Can man really change the climate? That's the question. Anyone who studied it on any kind of a serious basis knows the answer is no, we can't. I always laugh. The big example is, do you know how high the CO2 level is? And I always say, yeah, I know how high it is. Well, man caused that. And I'm like,
it's in the troposphere, right?
Yeah. Well, man did not cause that. I said, we contribute at a maximum estimate about 6% of the CO2 that goes into the atmosphere. The real number is probably around 3%. And so we can't possibly be the cause. Well, what is the cause? Well, it's natural sources. I mean, volcanism, trees and green plants themselves. There are all kinds of things that contribute to CO2. The fact that the ocean's a little warmer drives CO2 out. And as the ocean cools off, then more CO2 will dissolve. I'm not going to go into the physics and the chemistry of that, but the fact is that one of the reasons that you keep pop cold is to keep the CO2 dissolved in the pop, because when you warm it up, the CO2 comes out. That's why when you open a warm pop, it goes, whoosh, because all the CO2 is out of the fluid and up in the empty space of the can.
Yep.
Or the 2-liter bottle. So what might stop that, you know, states indicting a federal official for that is the fact that this particular effort is crashing and burning as we speak.
Wouldn't doubt that a bit. Now, you know, it's interesting, Chuck, that you bring up greenhouse gases and the environment, because, you know, I think we're going to add to the CO2 in Ohio here, well, maybe not soon, because today as we record this, and kind of a segue here, just so everybody, so they've got full information, today as we record this is the day that Ohio's medical marijuana legalization law goes into effect. You know, it was passed in the legislature in the spring and then signed by the governor, and it takes 90 days before it goes into effect. Well, today, which was, we're recording this, is September the 8th. Today's the day. So is everybody going to start doing their medical marijuana here in Ohio tomorrow, Chuck? Well, no, they're not, because nothing's been set up yet. There are no growers. There are no processors. There's no places to sell it in Ohio. All that stuff's still being worked on. And the funny thing is, Chuck, you know, when this legislation was passed by the General Assembly back in May, the presumption among legislative leaders, including the House Speaker Pro Tem, who was like one of the key people behind this bill, Kirk Schuring from Canton, believed fully in the reports that they were hearing that it was imminent that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, who handles these type of issues at the federal level, were within a matter of days going to be removing cannabis, marijuana, from the list of controlled substances. Right now, you know, at that point in time, it was on the controlled substance list as a Schedule I controlled substance, which meant that it was illegal to sell it or possess it in anywhere. Because that's the federal controlled substance. That's not a state-level thing. That's the federal. But, you know, there were assurances made that the Obama administration was going to be, their FDA was going to be making an announcement that they were going to remove marijuana from the Schedule I controlled substance list. Well, an announcement was made, Chuck. I think this was back in maybe late July, beginning of August. Announcement was made. They're keeping marijuana on the Schedule I controlled substance list for the foreseeable future, which means we now have set up a situation in Ohio where, by Ohio law, it is legal to process, sell, grow, process, sell, possess, and use marijuana for medical purposes. But it's a federal felony to do any of those things. So now we have a conflict between state and federal law. And Chuck, you're a constitutional student. What does our Constitution say about that?
Well, okay. Now here's where we get the arm wrestling match with Article 6.
Yes, we do.
Because it's the Supremacy Clause. The Supremacy Clause supposedly holds in this case. Now, you and I would look at it and say, well, now, wait a minute. There's no, absolutely no power to deal with regulation of any kind of substance in the Constitution granted to the federal government, which means that the state should be in control of what kind of substances are available and which ones aren't. But the federal government has stepped in and usurped the power from the states. And as it stands, the courts would probably find in favor of the federal government because of Article 6. The Supremacy Clause.
Right. Yep. Exactly.
So
now, and here raises another hairy thing. Now, this is there are two different issues that got raised here immediately with this, especially since they announced when the FDA didn't take it off the controlled substance list. First thing that got that happened was the question arose: would lawyers who work for the marijuana industry, whether it's the growers, the processors, the suppliers, the dispensaries, whoever, can they, without putting their law license in jeopardy, because it's still a federal felony, illegal offense to do anything with marijuana by federal law, are they putting their law licenses in jeopardy if they represent someone in the marijuana industry in Ohio?
Oh, my gosh.
Well, the Supreme Court's trying to figure out how they're going to write rules to say, no, it's okay. However, the other side of that coin, and this is one that came up because, again, today it becomes officially a law in Ohio, but you still can't get marijuana for medical purposes in Ohio under the rubrics of what was set up in law, because nothing's been set up yet. There are no growers. There are no processors. There are no distributors. And so if you have a medical need for marijuana, now, and again, Chuck, let's be clear and be fair. I'll be fair. They did put a prohibition in there. You can't grow it yourself at home, and you cannot smoke it as a means of and taking in this medical marijuana.
Yeah,
you can do oils or infusions or vaping or other things, but you can't actually like light up a joint. Okay.
Yep.
So that's still illegal no matter what, federal or state level. But in order to do this now, you're going to have to go to other states that have legalized it, like Colorado or our friends to the north in Michigan. But then the question arises, if you are a Ohio resident who's suffering and needs, you believe you need marijuana for medical pain control and symptom mitigation, and you take a drive up to Windsor or Detroit or Flint or whoever, wherever in Michigan, or you go out to Colorado to visit family and friends, and you purchase marijuana, which in those states it's legal to purchase because they're already set up, even though it's still federally a controlled substance and illegal by the federal law. But if you buy yourself a quantity of that marijuana product and you come back to Ohio, have you put yourself in jeopardy of interstate violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause, which makes it a federal issue, which then makes it that Ohio's laws couldn't cover you in the first place because you now transported an illegal controlled substance across state lines?
Well, the answer is yes. Now, you mentioned yes. Windsor. You would then have be in violation of international law.
Yeah, you're right, because Windsor's Canada. Yes.
That's it.
You're right. But, so you'd be in violation of international law at that point. You're right. I went a little too
I was going to say, wow, now we're branching out into
and like there aren't people in Windsor who are getting marijuana in Detroit right. and taking it back across the border.
Well, it's a little tougher because let's face it. I mean, I've been to Windsor a couple of times both ways, the Ambassador Bridge and through the tunnel, and you got customs on both ends. I wouldn't want to deal with that.
Yeah, but I think this is hilarious because one of the sponsors in an article in the Dispatch today basically says, well, the law doesn't dictate where people may buy medical marijuana. It's like, well, yeah, but the
yes,
federal
does.
Law
yeah.
does.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact.
It does.
And so you've got the situation that, okay, and this is the other problem too, Chuck, and this is something they had to deal with because of medical issues. Medical doctors, even under this new law, a medical doctor cannot prescribe medical marijuana to a patient. The only thing a patient can get is a recommendation from a physician, because writing a prescription puts you under federal law, and it's illegal to write a prescription for a Schedule I controlled substance.
And you know what? Doctors have been doing it in Ohio for years.
Yes, they have.
Recommendation. That's right. The sheriff's offices in a number of counties have simply looked the other way. Because they're well aware that there are people that use it for things like eliminating the nausea of chemotherapy and glaucoma and a number of things.
Yep.
So, you know, where's this going to end up? Well, look, folks, eventually it's going to result in we're on the downhill slope to complete decriminalization, honestly.
Oh. Sure. Now, the way they've got this set up, Chuck, the system, this whole system of how this is going to work in Ohio is overseen by the Department of Commerce, which is an appointed office by a governor, the Board of Pharmacy, and the State Medical Board, and an appointed advisory committee, which is usually legislators and people from the public appointed by the legislators. They're going to oversee all this. Well, we've already got a problem, because just yesterday an article came out in the Associated Press that the head of the state medical board, the president of Ohio's medical board, has announced that he has to recuse himself from anything dealing with this marijuana situation because he's a lobbyist who represents marijuana companies. He represents the Marijuana Policy Group, which is the group that was pushing for a ballot initiative for medical marijuana, and a grower called Pharm, PHARM, LLC. So you already have a situation where the head, the president of the state medical board in Ohio, who's supposed to be overseeing and creating the structure, has to step away from it because the marijuana industry is already lobbying up in order to get an advantage.
Yeah, of course. Not a shock. I wish we had more time to discuss this, because this is an important issue. But we don't. We are out of time.
Well, we'll have to come back to it.
We'll
on
have to
a,
come
on
back
subsequent
to this.
Program.
Yeah. Because I'm sure this isn't the end of it. But that being said, you know what we think. We now know what you want to think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.